when the U.S. government decided to imprison its own citizens of Japanese descent in camps after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, there were those in the government itself who pushed back.
There were lawsuits. You know, people, the Japanese Americans themselves, said this is unconstitutional and we're going to fight it in the court as a way to stand up for the Constitution because that's our patriotic duty. And then there were lawyers who took their cases, a lot of them from the ACLU and then some other organizations. And, of course, then the Justice Department, and this is the part of the story that I tell in the most detail, the Justice Department had to defend those suits and defend what the government was doing. And the government lawyers, some of them, didn't believe in the position that they were forced to take. So some of them actually, if you look at all of the documents, some of them actually seemed to be trying to lose. So they were trying to throw these cases because they thought the government should lose.
That's Kermit Roosevelt. We talk with him about his novel, Allegiance. It's a murder mystery that has the internal debate over the internment of Japanese Americans at its core. Then we re-air our interview with Pamela Rottner Sakamoto about her book, Midnight in Broad Daylight. It's the true story of a Japanese-American family sundered by World War II on both sides of the Pacific. One side suffered internment. The other side of the family were there when the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima on August 6, 1945. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. It was named Executive Order 9066 and signed by President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the order to incarcerate thousands of Japanese-American families in internment camps during World War II. It was a gross violation of civil rights, a blot on FDR's administration and on the Supreme Court, which ruled it constitutional in 1944. But not everyone in the government was on board. Now, a sophisticated legal thriller explores the debate within the internal controversy surrounding the internment. It's called Allegiance, and it was written by my guest, Kermit Roosevelt, a distant relative of FDR himself and great-great-grandson of Teddy Roosevelt. His protagonist is Cash Harrison, clerk to Supreme Court Justice Hugo Black. He and another clerk stumble onto a potential conspiracy aimed at manipulating the court's decisions, including those around the constitutionality of the internment camps. Cash's investigation takes him from the office of FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover to an internment camp in California, where he directly confronts the consequences of America's wartime policies. Kermit Roosevelt's highly successful first novel was In the Shadow of the Law. He is a law professor at the University of Pennsylvania and a former clerk for U.S. Supreme Court Justice David Souter. Kermit Roosevelt, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
So this novel, Allegiance, is your second novel, also on a legal theme. This takes place in 1944, right after the Pearl Harbor bombing, and it features a very likable young man, Cash Harrison, who wants to do his patriotic duty, but is unable to serve in the Army because he has he's 4F. So instead, he gets a job clerking in the Supreme Court for Hugo Black. You also were a Supreme Court clerk.
Yes, I was a clerk for Justice Souter.
And so you were able to draw on a lot of that experience here. You must have done a whole lot of research on what the court was like back in those days. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. I did an enormous amount of research. I read biographies of all of the justices. I read their autobiographies and their correspondence and their diaries to the extent that those were available. So I did a lot of research. It's also personal in a lot of ways because having clerked, I had the experience of sort of what the relationship with the justice is like. And so for some of the things that I couldn't find in my research, I did fill in the details from my own experience. For instance, one of the things that Cash does, he plays tennis with Hugo Black. And I couldn't figure out exactly what Hugo Black's tennis game was like, so I filled in some of the details there based on my own experiences playing tennis with Justice Scalia, which I did a couple times.
So the clerks get to have relationships with all the justices, is that right? Or at least just not just their own?
Yeah, not just their own. And I think actually in the period that I was writing about, it was probably easier because there were fewer clerks. So back then, each justice would typically only have one clerk. Now they usually have four. So I think it was probably easier then to form really deep and meaningful relationships. And of course, that's part of what I describe.
Yeah, you do. And in fact, Hugo Black takes a kind of, you know, paternal care of his of Cash Harrison. But the real relationship that he has, the deeper relationship, ends up being with Justice Felix Frankfurter.
Yes. Well, Justice Frankfurter ends up playing a larger role in the plot, probably, than Hugo Black does. I mean, he's more of an active player.
Yeah, and tell us a little bit about Felix Frankfurter, at least as he appears as a character in this book, Allegiance.
Well, Frankfurter was one of the difficult characters to write because he's one who straddles the line a little bit between the fictional part of the book and the historical part of the book. Generally speaking, I try to have real historical characters do what they really did and say what they really did. And I do that with Frankfurter as much as I can, but he also gets a little bit involved in the murder mystery thriller aspects of the book, which are fiction rather than historical fact. So he goes a little bit into fictional territory. But the impression that I got from all of my research about Frankfurter was he was very interested in pulling the strings and controlling things and manipulating things from behind the scenes. So I thought that he was a likely person, you know, if anyone on the Supreme Court was going to turn into a detective and try to figure out what was going on and unravel the conspiracy, Frankfurter was the likely guy to do it. So he's the Supreme Court justice who works as a detective, basically.
And he was also the first Jew on the court. Is that correct?
Well, I would have thought Brandeis before him, actually.
Oh, you're right. Oh, of course, Justice Brandeis. How could I forget that? But his Jewishness really does play a part in the development of this character. And in fact, in your book, you know, it is noteworthy to see the amount of anti-Semitism that existed at that time. The time of the Nazis, but nonetheless a time where it was kind of okay to discriminate against Jews.
Yeah. Oh, there was a lot of anti-Semitism, a lot of different forms of discrimination. You know, I if you look at history, I think that each generation really has its own forms of discrimination. You know, there are some that are salient and are being challenged and that people are starting to turn against. And then there are some that generation doesn't even think of as problematic yet. And in the future, people will look back and say that was terrible, but that generation doesn't even really notice it. And, you know, to a large part, anti-Semitism in polite society in America in the 1940s was perfectly acceptable.
Right. And there's another kind of prejudice that's even more inimical in this book, and that's a prejudice against Japanese Americans. And, in fact, the book hinges or rotates around the whole controversy around the evacuation, so-called, of Japanese to, you know, evacuation seems such a benign term, like we evacuate people for their own safety, but that's certainly not what was done as Japanese were put into the internment camps. Talk a little bit about the history of how that decision got made and the controversy that it occasioned.
Well, it was a controversial decision, which I think is something that people need to understand looking back. So it's not the case that everyone thought this was a regrettable necessity or a good idea or something that just had to be done. At the time, there were plenty of people who said, this isn't necessary, this is motivated by racism and prejudice, this is motivated in some cases by economic self-interest. So one of the groups that was really pushing for the removal of the Japanese Americans was actually the Salinas Fruit Growers Association, which wanted to eliminate economic competition from Japanese and Japanese American farms. So it was controversial, but it probably didn't get the attention it deserved. Because if you look inside the government, really I think my sense of what happened was there were some people who sincerely, though in large part because of racism, believed that the Japanese American population was a threat. And they said, we need to do this. And they became the dominant voice in the War Department. And then no one was really willing to stand up to them. Francis Biddle, who was the head of the Justice Department, could have, but he didn't want to take the side of the Japanese Americans against people like him, respected establishment figures. And FDR, of course, could have also, but he just didn't really care enough. If his generals said that this was necessary, he was willing to do what they advised, because he thought basically he had more important things to worry about.
But there were those who actually then, I mean, if what you're writing about actually happened, there were those who brought legal suit against the government in order to have this overturned. And in fact, that's one of the plot points, because there's a young Jewish clerk who, you know, was of all of the clerks is someone who does care very much about this, maybe because he senses the commonality of prejudice that's being exercised against the Japanese.
Yes, and that's a real historical figure, Jean Gressman, who did really act much in the way he's described in the book. He actually went on to a long legal career, so he's different in some ways from the way he is in the book. But yes, so there were lawsuits. You know, people, the Japanese Americans themselves, said this is unconstitutional and we're going to fight it in the court as a way to stand up for the Constitution because that's our patriotic duty. And then there were lawyers who took their cases, a lot of them from the ACLU and then some other organizations. And, of course, then the Justice Department, and this is the part of the story that I tell in the most detail, the Justice Department had to defend those suits and defend what the government was doing. And the government lawyers, some of them, didn't believe in the position that they were forced to take. So some of them actually, if you look at all of the documents, some of them actually seemed to be trying to lose. So they were trying to throw these cases because they thought the government should lose.
And J. Edgar Hoover played a role in this as well, and a surprising role.
Yeah, J. Edgar Hoover's role is interesting because, of course, we don't think of J. Edgar Hoover as a big supporter of civil liberties, which he wasn't. But in this case, actually, he was on the right side of history. He was saying, this isn't necessary. There's no security threat. And he was saying that in part because the FBI had actually gone in and arrested about 5,000 Japanese and Japanese-American men immediately after Pearl Harbor. And Hoover's position was, I have handled this. There's no danger. If you say that anything more needs to be done, you're questioning my judgment and expertise. So not necessarily for the right reasons. It was more sort of to protect his image. But he was actually against the removal of the Japanese-Americans.
So in other words, it was a kind of rivalry between the FBI and the Justice Department and military.
Yes. Yeah, the military was insisting that national security demanded things that the FBI was saying it did not. And the FBI, of course, looking back, was correct on that.
Well, there's a special salience, it seems to me, to some of the controversies going around today, where people are questioning the loyalty of Americans if they happen to be Muslim. Is that right?
Well, yes. I think it's exactly the same thing. This is the same psychological reaction we always have in times of fear, because we start to think that people who aren't like us in some way aren't real Americans. So in the World War II era, it was race. And, you know, people thought birthright American citizens, you know, born on American soil, because of the color of their skin, they weren't real Americans. They couldn't be trusted. And we see very similar thinking now. It's based more on religion, although there is sort of a racial aspect to it, too. But, yes, that's the way that people are viewing American Muslims now.
Do you think it's going to come down to loyalty oaths and pledges of allegiance?
Well, I hope not, and I don't think so, because I do think one of the great things about America is that we learn from our mistakes. And if you look at American history at any particular moment, it can be hard to tell if we're going forward or back. But if you look at it in 50-year increments, I think we go forward. And I do think that we've learned a lot from this historical episode. It's not as well known as it should be. That's in part why I wrote the book. But I think, you know, the past holds a lot of lessons on this point, and I certainly hope that we'll be able to learn them.
Now, Allegiance is the title of your novel, Kermit Roosevelt, and it refers probably to both the larger sense of allegiance, but also a particular case, the Pledge of Allegiance case?
Yes. So one of the amazing things that I realized while I was researching and writing this book was that one thing the government tried to do was it tried to determine who was loyal and who wasn't among the Japanese-American population by requiring them to take various oaths, which never worked. The government could never do a very good job of trying to sort the loyal from the disloyal, you know, in part because there weren't very many disloyal people. But all of that was going on at exactly the same time the Supreme Court was deciding the case of West Virginia Board of Education against Barnett, which is one of the more well-known Supreme Court cases. And what they said there was the government cannot require school children to salute the flag and recite the Pledge of Allegiance, which is sort of an ironic juxtaposition, because when it comes to school children, the government says it's one of actually the maybe the best written Supreme Court opinions. It's written by Justice Robert Jackson. The Supreme Court says if there's one fixed star in our constitutional constellation, it's that no official, high or petty, can force a confession of faith. And yet at the same time, exactly this is going on with the Japanese Americans. And in fact, they're saying, if you don't take this oath, we believe you are disloyal, and we'll send you to a special segregation center in Tula Lake Camp, California. So it shows how different justice is for different kinds of Americans.
Right. We've been seeing that with the Black Lives Matter movement as well. Although that's in the arena of policing, but certainly the courts weigh in on this as well, no?
Well, yeah, you know, there are lots of racial disparities in sentencing, for instance. People have been outraged recently by the sentence handed down to Brock Turner, that Stanford swimmer who was convicted of sexual assault. And certainly if you look at the sentences imposed on minority defendants in similar cases, I don't think you'll find a lot of people getting off with the same kind of sentence he did.
Mm. You know, that era of the Supreme Court, a liberal court. Yeah, Roosevelt packed the court, did he not, with liberal justices? And yet, how did they justify, or how did the legal system justify violating the Constitution in this way of just imprisoning Americans without any form, without any due process?
Well, the Roosevelt court is an interesting court, because Roosevelt certainly did pack it, and he put people on it with certain views for particular purposes. But basically, what he wanted them to do was let the federal government regulate. So he wanted justices who would uphold the New Deal and wouldn't interfere with federal regulation of the economy as the federal oversight expanded. And so what he got was a lot of justices who trusted the federal government and a lot of justices who maybe trusted Roosevelt personally. So it's not that surprising, actually, that they didn't interfere with this, you know, national security, military necessity, action by the federal government. The Roosevelt Court isn't a big individual rights court. We do think of it as liberal, but it's not the Warren Court. The Warren Court comes later. Mm-hmm. Some of the justices overlap, of course. So Hugo Black does end up to be a very strong civil libertarian. William Douglas does too. But the Roosevelt Court is very deferential to the federal government.
So even if the federal government is doing the right thing, maybe we shouldn't be given so much power to it?
Well, I think, you know, what we have to understand is that the government can't always be trusted. So sort of trust but verify. Because, you know, it's possible to figure out, I think, and this is one of the things that the Supreme Court seems to have taken as a lesson from the World War II cases, it's possible to figure out whether the government, in fact, has a good justification for what it's doing or not. This is something that judges are capable of doing. And if you look at the post-September 11th terrorism cases, you'll see the Supreme Court has become a lot more confident about its ability to investigate whether there is, in fact, a basis for the national security claims that the government makes.
Can you cite some examples of that?
So in the World War II era, FDR wins basically all of his cases. He does actually lose one where the Supreme Court says you can't detain individuals without some reason to think that they're disloyal. But, you know, he wins the Korematsu case where the Supreme Court says it's okay to remove all of the Japanese Americans from their homes, make them leave the West Coast. If you look at the post-September 11th cases, President Bush tries to set up military tribunals following his own rules, and the Supreme Court says, no, you can't do that. He says non-citizens detained at Guantanamo Bay shouldn't have any right of access to the courts. The Supreme Court says no. He says they shouldn't have any opportunity to demonstrate their innocence. The Supreme Court says no, they should have that opportunity. So it's a pretty consistent pattern of the courts saying, basically, we let the executive branch, we let the government do whatever it said was necessary in World War II. We look back on that and think we kind of got taken for a ride. It didn't work out very well. We're not just going to accept whatever you say this time.
I want to ask you what those conditions in the Japanese internment camps were, but before I do that, just staying on this issue of the court, you know, many people have said that this is an activist court. I mean, they've overturned the Voting Rights Act. They did Citizens United. What can you say about the way they're acting now vis-a-vis their whole view of the power of the judiciary versus the executive or the legislative?
Well, the whole question of activism is a very difficult one, and there aren't a lot of people out there who have a consistent theory of activism. They tend just to say a decision is activist when they don't like it, which is to say everyone wants the court to be activist sometimes. That is, they want it to stand up to the other branches of government. And then pretty much everyone also thinks sometimes the court should be deferential. The big question, the hard question, is figuring out when the court should basically trust the government and say, you know, unless it looks like something's gone really, really wrong, we're going to let you do what you want here, and when it should be suspicious. And in my view, the Roberts Court is probably suspicious of the government sometimes when it shouldn't be, and it's accepting also sometimes when it shouldn't be. I don't really agree with the pattern of decisions there.
You mean the ones that I referred to on the Voting Rights Act?
Yeah, the ones that you referred to. So, you know, the Voting Rights Act is a good example where Congress assembles this massive, massive record of attempts to disenfranchise minority voters. And based on lots and lots of evidence that they have, they say, we think we should reauthorize the Voting Rights Act. And the Supreme Court just says, your evidence isn't good enough for us. We think differently. So they're not really giving any weight to Congress's conclusions, which is strange because, you know, the 15th Amendment gives the power to Congress to enforce the amendment. You know, so Congress, if you look at the words of the Constitution, Congress probably deserves a little bit more respect there.
If you just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Kermit Roosevelt about his latest novel, Allegiance. So in Allegiance, at a certain point, there is a murder mystery, and Cash is trying to solve it, and he goes and visits an internment camp. Could you talk a little bit about what those internment camps were really like?
The camps were pretty primitive. So you had a large population, you had 120,000 people or so, who were there for 4 years or even longer in some cases. And so they had to have everything that a community that size would need. And, they, you know, they had children, so they had to have schools. But it was all very primitive. There were tar paper barracks. Dust would blow through the walls. It was certainly not anything like the conditions that most of these people were used to in their homes.
And you also point out that there were, as you said before, there were some business interests, local business interests. What happened to the property? I mean, where was the self-interest of people who were not Japanese Americans served by this internment of their neighbors?
Well, another part of the self-interest that came out was that once it became clear that the Japanese Americans were going to have to leave, and they were told basically take only what you can carry, it was clear that they were going to have to dispose of their property or find people to take care of it. And sadly, the surrounding community really took advantage of them. So people were offered insultingly low prices for family heirlooms, and in many cases, families would smash their ancestral china rather than sell it for what was being offered. And with the real property, the houses and the land, sometimes the Japanese Americans would be able to find someone who said they would take care of it. Sometimes when they came back, that person would refuse to give it back. But in many cases, the land was just considered abandoned. And then actually frequently the government would take it.
So there was
just a vast, basically theft of Japanese American property.
It sounds so much like what happened to Jews in, for example, Amsterdam at the same time.
They're very disturbing parallels.
So in doing this research, then, you know, we've talked about some of the parallels to today. And in writing this book, was there anything that you found as you were going through this book that changed your view of how things happen? I mean, did you start out with a pretty clear idea of what the issues were going to be and what you were trying to do, or was there an evolution?
Well, you know, I started out with a lot of questions, actually, because I thought that there were similarities between the two time periods, between the past and the present. But I wanted to know what people had thought then and what people felt and the issues that they struggled with. And it turned out much more closely than I thought. It turned out that they were all the same issues. This is just a human psychological pattern that repeats itself.
That's interesting that you think this is like an eternal pattern, or do you think that there are some forces in U.S. society or even modern society that might have allowed this to happen in the way it did? I mean, for example, a society that has a certain state position. After all, we've been at war pretty much since World War II, haven't we?
Well, we've had a lot of wars. I mean, the big difference that I see with the generation that's growing up now, though, is that they have literally always been at war. The generation that sort of came of age after September 11th, their whole experience is there's a permanent low-level state of war, whereas that was not my experience. When I was growing up, it was the Cold War, and we were sort of terrified that any slight conflict could escalate into World War III. But generally, the U.S. military was not actually fighting when I was growing up. Now we've got permanent war, which has very different consequences for what people think about the appropriate role of the government in terms of surveillance of civilians and national security and all of that sort of stuff.
Well, that's exactly where I was angling. This is less about human nature than it may be about a certain kind of society that is on a permanent war footing.
Well, I think there's some truth to that. You know, in that when you're on a war footing, you're always looking for the enemy. And it's maybe even more acute now because the enemy is not a nation. It's not a nation that we can fight. There isn't going to be a formal surrender. There isn't going to be a peace treaty. The enemy could be anyone. And that, I think, makes people more afraid and more suspicious.
Now, I wanted to ask you another question, which is, you are the great-grandson of Theodore Roosevelt. Obviously, this book takes place in during FDR's reign, who was a cousin of Theodore Roosevelt, isn't that correct? Second cousin of something?
Yes, a second cousin.
Are any of the characters in your book people that your family might have known?
Well, I mean, there's a reference actually to my great-grandfather. So Felix Frankfurter was a big fan of Theodore Roosevelt. He worked for Theodore Roosevelt. He wanted to support the Bull Moose Party when Theodore Roosevelt broke away from the Republicans. So there are a number of family connections there. And I actually mentioned my great-grandfather once.
Yeah. Did you grow up with any stories of Felix Frankfurter or any of these characters?
No, not really. Mm-hmm. I mean, nothing that's not better explored in their biographies.
Well, it's a really interesting read. I mean, through the lens of fiction, how you examine this, you know, as you said, probably the most shameful violation of civil liberties, aside from, of course, slavery and the wholesale appropriation of Native American lands that we
well,
have
right.
done.
Well, right. We've got a bunch of things.
Yeah. Well, Kermit Roosevelt, it's been great to talk with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much. My pleasure.
Kermit Roosevelt's first novel was In the Shadow of the Law. He is a law professor at the University of Pennsylvania and a former clerk for U.S. Supreme Court Justice David Souter. You can read an excerpt from his latest novel, Allegiance, by going to writersvoice.net. Next, we re-air an interview I did earlier this year with Pamela Rottner Sakamoto about her book, Midnight in Broad Daylight. It paints a vivid picture of what it was like in the Japanese-American internment camps during World War II. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When historian Pamela Rottner Sakamoto was working on her dissertation in Japan, she stumbled on a story so remarkable, she vowed to write about it when her dissertation was finished. The story is about Harry Fukuhara, a Japanese-American decorated hero of World War II, and his family, who were divided by that war on both sides of the Pacific. Moreover, the family was originally from Hiroshima, and Harry's older brother, Victor, ended up dying from radiation sickness after the U.S. dropped the atom bomb on his city. Sakamoto's book, Midnight in Broad Daylight, tells how the Fukuhara family came to America, what they found there, why some of them returned to their ancestral home in Japan, and how the war first divided and then united them. It also talks about how they confronted discrimination in America and how they overcame it to survive and thrive. It's a terrific tale that reads like a novel. Pamela Rottner Sakamoto is an American historian. She's fluent in Japanese and lived in Kyoto and Tokyo for 17 years. She now lives and teaches in Hawaii. I spoke to her in January via Skype and started out by asking her how the Fukuhara family first came to America.
Well, Harry's father was a young boy impoverished in Hiroshima Prefecture, and many immigrants to the United States from Japan came from Hiroshima Prefecture. And he emigrated in the early 1900s to work on the railroads, which is part of the great American story of expanding the frontier. And he was relatively successful enough actually to rise to the professional class, and he called for a bride, and there was an arranged marriage, and his wife, Kinu, also came from Hiroshima Prefecture. She was a picture bride, and she came around 1911, and then they had five children in the Seattle area, and Katsuji, the father, and the mother, Kinu, are Issei, or first-generation Japanese-Americans, and their five children, American-born, American citizens, were Nisei, or second-generation Japanese-Americans, and their story is extremely typical of the wave of Japanese emigration to the West Coast and Hawaii from the late 1800s to the early 1900s, when it was completely stopped.
With great effort and persistence, Harry's father, Katsuchi, overcame prejudice to become a kind of bridge between the Anglo and Japanese communities. And like so many immigrants, he concentrated his hopes on his children's future.
He bore the American dream for his children, that they would graduate from colleges. He could not because they had been born and were being raised in the U.S., and that they would be white-collar workers and that they would someday own their own homes. He, as a Japanese immigrant, could not, by law in the state of Washington, purchase land or ever become a citizen of the United States. But he wanted that for his children. His children, of course, were born citizens, but he wanted them to be able to buy land someday and achieve every one of their dreams.
Yeah, so talk a little bit more about the racism and the discrimination that they encountered. I mean, some of the Japanese had their own farms, had been able to buy land, but then things changed.
Right. They slowly lost that through legislation at the state level. It was happening in California as well as Washington. And they gradually were forced to give up their land, and they were becoming tenant farmers. So they essentially came over to work on the railroads, worked very hard, were able to become farmers and owners, and then found themselves slipping back. And even their children, who were raised to value education and to excel in school and to really be fully engaged Americans, even if they were able to enter, for example, the University of California, Berkeley, or Stanford, you know, really wonderful schools, the schools didn't have any hopes for them either that the children would be able to enter fine professions because firms would not hire them. So at every level, people, Japanese and Japanese Americans, faced obstacles, and Harry's family came up against these as well. As Japanese farmers lost their land, Harry's father's business diminished, and he sort of expanded into dairies and helping truck farmers take their produce to Pike's Market in Seattle. But he was always on the edge. He was always sort of calculating in his head and keeping his worries from his family.
Now, there are five children, as you say, all born in America. The two older siblings, Mary and Victor, were sent back to Japan when they were still children. Why were they sent back?
This, too, is very much part of the Japanese experience in the United States. Parents saw the discrimination, and they worried that their American children would not be able to achieve those very dreams that they held for them. And they thought that if their children went back to Japan, stayed with relatives, attended Japanese school, got some level of competency in the difficult Japanese language, and then returned to the U.S. later, they would have a better chance. For Victor as a boy, and then in the future as a man, he would be able to, for example, work in a Japanese trading company or even work at a Japanese government office as an American employee. And they felt that that was a potential route for success, much as today we think that the more languages we speak, the more marketable we are. And for Mary, they hoped that she would be a respectable or a match for a well-educated young Japanese-American man, because she would be both refined in Japanese ways and also fully American. What happened, though, was when the kids went abroad, and this happened with many families, is that it was very hard to come back and reintegrate into American society. Their English suffered. They were different from the rest of their families when they returned, and there was this disconnect.
So the two oldest kids were sent to Japan, and then the rest of the family followed. They followed after Father Katsuji died, and so Mother Kinu brought her three younger children, Harry, Pierce, and Frank, to Japan with her. Why did she go back at that point?
So in 1933, the height of the Great Depression, Harry's father contracted pleurisy. He died, and his widow knew that she could not make a living in the United States, and nor could her children fully. And she had very little left in her savings account, maybe just enough for a few months more of rent. But if she went back to Japan, and she would receive some life insurance money, the dollar, because of the exchange rate, would go much further. She had a large and loving and prosperous family, and they would help her out. And she was just much more comfortable there. So she felt that she had no choice because financially she could not stay. But it was devastating for the kids, who regarded themselves as American, and for particularly 13-year-old Harry, a young adolescent fully at home in the United States, who regarded Japan, where he had never been, is very foreign. But his sister Mary, too, was not thrilled about being in Japan. And everybody would go back, but some of them would have more of a rocky landing.
And what was the situation for the kids? I mean, they faced real discrimination in Japan because of their Americanness. So talk about this kind of culture clash that was affecting them.
Right, they were caught between two worlds, truly. Once they returned to Japan, they were viewed as foreigners and as Americans, and Japan, by this point, was already on a war footing. Tensions were rising, actually. Japan was at combat in China, and there was an anti-American sentiment as well. So they didn't speak very good Japanese at all. Harry was in the second grade in Japanese class in Seattle, his after-school class, because he had no interest in learning and tried actively not to learn. So when he went to Japan as a 13-year-old, he was placed in the second grade. And we can imagine how much he enjoyed that. He quickly quit, and his mom hired him a tutor, and she had to find another school, and she found a school that was charging tuition for Japanese American students and teaching some of its classes initially in English. And he made this whole pack of Japanese American friends because there were other kids in Hiroshima who, like Mary and Victor, had been sent back by their families for their education. But he needed this network of Japanese American friends because he felt very much adrift, as did the other kids, but Victor and Mary had the language, and the younger boys, Pierce and Frank, they were able to pick up the language and adapt. Harry also became very fluent in Japanese, but psychologically his heart and emotionally his heart was still in the States.
In fact, as Pamela Sakamoto describes in her book Midnight in Broad Daylight, Harry returned to the U.S., but he found his childhood friends had moved on, and anti-Japanese sentiment was on the rise. The only work he could find was as a day laborer working in the fields. His sister, who had returned with him, got married and moved away. Then war broke out between Japan and the U.S. in December of 1941. So then we come up to 1941 and the attack on Pearl Harbor. What was the immediate impact of that attack on the Japanese community in the U.S.?
Immediately, there were roundups by the FBI of leaders in the Japanese community, for example, Japanese language school principals or Buddhist church leaders. So the level of fear within 24 hours was just palpable. And Harry was living and working for a Caucasian family in the Los Angeles area in Glendale. They were very loving towards him, but he also had a lot of jobs, like gardening jobs on the side, and he was on the spot as Pearl Harbor occurred. He was fired by his employer, and she was a friendly woman, and he didn't really understand what was going on. He didn't even know where Pearl Harbor was, but he tasted the anger and the fear immediately, and the situation would only get worse.
And then he and Mary were evacuated like all of the other Japanese Americans in the western part of the United States. They were evacuated to these concentration camps. What were they like? First, they were basically evacuated to a stable or a barn.
Right. It was a very hastily organized affair. In February of 1942, President Franklin Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066, and this basically allowed, quote, evacuation to occur. And the military on the West Coast, the command immediately started making plans. But within 3 months, they were moving people. And so Harry and Mary were sent to Tulare, which was a county fairgrounds, and they were housed in basically a horse stall. You could still see the hay. You could still smell the previous occupants. There was very little that had been added. There was a dangling bare light bulb overhead. And that was just a temporary solution while these concentration camps, as you put it, and that's what they are called today, although they were called relocation centers at the time or internment camps. But even President Roosevelt used the term concentration camp. In August of 1942, after spending several months at Tulare, they were transferred to Gila River in Arizona, one of 10 concentration camps in these remote areas of the United States. That, too, was an unfinished affair. They could see between the slats of their barrack the sand of the desert underneath. Sand blew everywhere with frequent sandstorms. It was bleak. It was guarded. They had no idea how long they would be there, and that uncertainty was excruciating. It was a very dark period, particularly for Harry, who was 22. He did not have that college education now that his dad had wanted for him. and he didn't know what would follow. Mary had a little girl, Jeannie, and so she was able to focus her energies on the sweetness of a young child, but they both struggled.
So he found a way out. He joined the Army. He became an Army linguist. Talk about the unit, you know, that was set up and how in some ways the war provided him with an opportunity.
Yes, he would be the first to say that. At the time, he didn't know. He didn't know much more than this was a way out of the camp. And he was becoming so bitter, so unfamiliar to himself, that the opportunity to leave was a relief. And so the Military Intelligence Service itself was very new. It was a hasty response to the realization that in the Pacific, the Japanese were a fierce enemy. They were on the upswing. The Allies were in deep trouble, and no one could decipher their language. And the Japanese knew this and were leaving maps and reports around battle fronts, but no one could figure it out. And if somebody could figure out the language, then there would be some tactical and strategic advantages. So Harry takes a test for this service, and he passes with flying colors from his time in Japan. And he, because his eyesight is so poor, thinks that he'll end up staying stateside and translating documents. But he's actually, like his dad, such an extrovert, so good with people, friendly, and so bilingual that he is sent to the Pacific to interrogate prisoners.
This is where you start talking about the nuances of his position. I mean, after all, here he is interrogating prisoners. He cannot think of them in the same way as his white colleagues in his unit do.
Now, they are very quick to fall in line behind the slogans, kill or be killed, there will be no more Pearl Harbors, never again. And Japanese prisoners, well, there are very few. Japanese soldiers do not surrender, officers in particular, and Americans do not take them alive. It works both ways. But Harry has a level of cultural understanding and empathy. I mean, he has no doubt that he's an American and that he has a job to do. When he interrogates Japanese prisoners of war near the front, he has to find out very quickly what kind of information they have and whether it can be put to good use. But he knows that they are not this subhuman enemy as depicted by the press and as swallowed by many. He knows that they're young men just like him.
Now, you don't really get into this. I mean, did he ever use torture to interrogate them?
What's really interesting, Harry and I talked a lot about this because of what was happening at the time that I was interviewing him with the whole discussion of torture in the United States and the Mideast. And Harry was emphatic about this, that torture did not work, that it was much better to be respectful and to recognize the person on the other side is clearly being in American hands, but that person should be treated, be given water, be given food, be given medical care, and that the kindness for that person's basic human dignity would elicit far more than torture.
Then he has to face the prospect of the U.S. Army invading Japan. He goes to the Philippines. He's there. The talk of invasion is swirling around. How does he feel about that?
Right, by the summer of 1945, he is in Manila, and he is looking at a November 45 invasion of Japan, and he just knows that it's going to be horrible. He does not believe that the Japanese will surrender women, children, the elderly. All of these civilians and soldiers will fight to the death. And he's worried about his family, his mom and his brothers, and he asks to be released, and he's not. And he knows that he must go. And it chills him. He will go and perform his job. He doesn't know whether he will survive, nor is he sure whether his family will. It will be a terrible battle.
And what was his reaction after the bombing of Hiroshima? He lost some family members there who, in fact, his brother Victor eventually dies of radiation sickness. What was his idea about that? Did he view it as a war crime?
That's really interesting. He was willing to discuss so much with me, but the atomic bomb was such a sensitive issue both for Harry and his brother Frank. Frank was in the Japanese Army. They were slated to be in the same place if an invasion had taken place by the Allies of Japan. Harry took the sort of standard line that the atomic bomb shortened the war significantly, and if an American invasion had taken place, and if it had taken a long time, and it probably would, in his mind, then the casualties on both sides would have been catastrophic, higher than they were with the bomb. But it wasn't something he was comfortable with, and Frank was not happy about the bomb, had much more conflicting feelings that he was willing to express. Harry never wanted to go to Hiroshima. That was the only place he resisted.
So finally, I'd like to ask you about how you wrote this book, because you create such vivid details about the lives of the characters. I mean, it reads like a novel. And I had to ask myself over and over again, how did you know this stuff?
It is very much putting together a puzzle over time. This book took a very long time. I met Harry in 1994, started the book with his full cooperation and that of his siblings in 1998, and it's just being published now. There was a lot of my listening to Harry and Frank and their surviving siblings at length, and then repeatedly interviewing and making sure that the story stayed the same, and then interviewing others who would have been in the same places at the same time and corroborating the accounts and then checking the documents.
I also remarked to Pamela Sakamoto that in her book, Midnight in Broad Daylight, there are dialogues reproduced that read like fiction, but they're fact. I wondered how she managed to so faithfully recreate them.
Harry, he was in his 70s and well into his 80s. He died in April at 95, but he had almost a photographic memory for names and dates, because I would record his story and take notes, and then I would go back and find documents, and it always matched up. So I was lucky with him. And then, for example, there was the neighbor of his mom in Hiroshima, and she was with his mother on the day of the atomic bomb. And she, too, had a fabulous memory. And a lot of this was research at the local level. She recreated the times for me of their neighborhood, of the larger extended family. And I was able to go to places as small as a local merchant association and look at their records. I was able to look at a lot of unpublished sources, photographs, old recordings, old newspapers, and that is how I did it.
Oh, you did a terrific job, and it is a terrific book, Midnight in Broad Daylight, A Japanese-American Family, Caught Between Two Worlds. Pamela Rottner Sakamoto, thank you so much for sharing this story with us here on Writer's Voice.
Francesca, thank you so much for today.
You can read an excerpt from Pamela Rottner Sakamoto's book, Midnight in Broad Daylight, by going to writersvoice.net. And that interview with Pamela Rottner Sakamoto first aired on Writer's Voice in February of this year. Next week, we talk with David Bollier about his new book on the commons, Patterns of Commoning. Here's a sneak preview. I asked Bollier to talk about what commoning is and what's new about this ancient concept today.
Well, if you mention the commons to someone, the first thing that they usually say is, oh yeah, the tragedy of the commons. And of course, this is comes from a famous 1968 essay called The Tragedy of the Commons, which claims that any shared resource will always be overused because nobody has any incentive to hold back. But the truth of the matter is the commons is not just an unowned resource that anybody can use, a free-for-all. It's a social system for collaborating and sharing and managing shared wealth. And so what I did with my German activist colleague, Silke Helfrich, was to collect dozens of examples from around the world in lots of different resource domains, from cities to digital spaces to farm settings and beyond, to show that the commons is actually a very sustainable, attractive, socially attractive way of managing shared wealth in ways that are fair and ecologically responsible.
Then I asked Bollier to talk about commoning as a response to social and environmental disasters and crises.
You could say that our world right now is on the threshold of a lot of disasters. And what I found in my book, Patterns of Commoning, was dozens of robust, successful examples of people coming together to create social collaborations to deal with problems. Things like time banking in Helsinki, where people give time and get barter credits for it. Or things like the humanitarian OpenStreetMap team, these open source coders who make instant maps for disaster areas like Haiti, so that people rescue in a humanitarian efforts can proceed. And you just find just a wealth of these kinds of examples, which is really kind of an archetype of human behavior that we just do not have represented in economics, politics, government, or many other places. And so that's what the commons is all about.
In fact, could you say that some of the anomie, to use a word that was coined in, what was that, by Durkheim in the 19th century, talked about, the alienation that we experience so much, the loneliness, the separateness of our society, stands in stark contrast to the kind of conviviality, use that term, of the commons?
Well, the free markets are all about impersonal transactions, and it's one-off. There's no lasting relationship. It's mediated by cash. And that causes a lot of alienation when the entire society is organized around the principles of markets. The purpose of commons, however, is to build enduring relationships that in which your labor is not something that's necessarily paid, but something you do because you have affection for each other, other people, and for the resources you're acting as a steward for. And so it's a whole different social paradigm that gets enormous amounts of work done, think of open source software or Linux, in which nobody is necessarily paid, and it's creating this massive resource of code that no corporation could possibly pay for. It's been estimated that it's worth more than $5 billion if you were to pay for all that work. The point is, the commons do all sorts of wonderful work while being socially satisfying and, as you say, convivial. And that's really what our society needs.
David Bollier. Tune in next week to hear my interview with him about his newest book, Patterns of Commoning. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.